without further ado, we're going to go right into it. I want to now invite you all to help me welcome Lenny Wolf. Lenny Wolf is a veteran. Lenny Wolf is a veteran revolutionary. He's an advocate for Bob Avakian's new communism, and he's actually joining us here also as part of the national organizing tour. So with that, I want you to help welcome Lenny Wolf. Yeah.
Eric Garner was 43 years old. Eric Garner was the father of six children. He was a peacemaker in the neighborhood. He had worked for the Parks Department as a horticulturalist until he became disabled. He was an ordinary guy who meant an awful lot to the people who knew him. And Eric Garner was a black human being in America. 5 years ago this July, New York police went to break up a fight in front of a bodega. By the time they got there, Eric had already settled the dispute between the two people, and the guys had left. But the police decided to arrest him for the crime of selling loose cigarettes without a license, a crime for which they had continually harassed and arrested him before. How many of you watched the video of what happened next? Those of you who have, do you remember how the big man asks why they continually harass him all the time and says it has to stop today? Did you see him maintain his dignity while taking great care not to make an aggressive move? Did you watch how the police put him in a chokehold and strangle him? How Eric Garner says, "I can't breathe," not once, not twice, but 11 times, and they keep him in the chokehold? How they let him die and lay in the street, never rendering CPR, waiting for 7 minutes for the ambulance to come? Or did you have to turn away? Maybe you heard that the other day, 5 years after this happened, when there's never been a trial for the cop who was let go, there was a disciplinary hearing because he's still on the force. And it came out that after this murder, the supervising officer had written a memo that said, "This is not a big deal." Not a big deal. Not a big deal, like the killing of Sandra Bland, where finally 2 weeks ago we saw the video of her video of what happened when she encountered a police officer outside of Houston after years of her video being suppressed. Watch the video and then ask yourself why nobody has ever done a day of time for her death. Not a big deal. Like each and every person on the poster over there, the faces of just some of the thousands of people a year who are killed by the police. You know, when the Revolution Club takes this poster, young kids in certain neighborhoods sometimes ask, "When they kill me, will my picture be on the poster?" Think of what goes into that question. To the people who run this system, to those who enforce it, the humanity and lives of black people, except as objects of profit and/or threats to be demonized and suppressed, have never been a big deal. As Bob Avakian, the leader of the revolution, said last summer, if this were the only thing wrong with this system, it would be more than enough reason to sweep it off the earth. But it's not the only thing wrong. In the very same week that this happened, Alabama's legislature said it was not a big deal to outlaw abortion and to force women to have children against their will and to send any doctor who helped them with an abortion to prison for 99 years. It was not a big deal for America to continue to support Saudi Arabia's war on the people of Yemen, a war which has cost the lives of almost 250,000 people. In that same week, we heard that 1 million species face extinction. Not a big deal. More families came looking every day for refuge from Central America, a place that's been devastated by decades of U.S. exploitation and horrific U.S.-sponsored violence, and now U.S.-generated climate change, only to have their families torn apart and placed in detention, intentionally traumatizing the children. Not a big deal. We say no, it is a big deal. We say stop this genocidal white supremacy. Stop this patriarchal degradation of women and all gender oppression. Stop the capitalist destruction of the environment. Stop the wars for empire, and stop this persecution of the immigrants. The five stops, these five horrors that this system continually generates and reproduces, no matter how hard people fight them, no matter how many reasonable sounding reforms people come up with. And now these five stops are made even worse by the existence of a fascist regime occupying the White House and on the offensive. Stopping these five stops is a very big deal, in fact, for humanity. But is it a big deal here at UCLA? Is it a big deal with you? Maybe you'll get your back up and say, who are you to say that to me? Come in here and talk like this. Do my part. I'm fighting in my own way. Well, let's look at some of the ways you are fighting. As the flyer for this program said, you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. Or to put it bluntly, and to quote Bob Avakian, let's get down to basics. We need a revolution. Anything else in the final analysis is bullshit. Let's take some of these solutions. Let's take Bernie Sanders, or BS. BS wants to divide the wealth of America more fairly. But does he ask where this wealth comes from? Does BS talk about the fact that your t-shirts are made in Bangladesh and the accident 6 years ago at the Rana Plaza factory in Bangladesh that killed over 700 women workers? Does he talk about the fact that on any given t-shirt exported from Bangladesh, 19 cents of what you pay at the counter goes back to Bangladesh, less than 1 cent of that going to the person who made the t-shirt, and the rest of it goes to the middlemen, the financial people, and the U.S. government itself? Does he mention that that would be where Medicare for All would come from? Does he talk about the workers in China who a few years ago began committing suicide to protest the conditions they worked under to produce our iPhones? And no, it doesn't count when he complains that China is taking our jobs and stirs up chauvinism instead of solidarity. In fact, the biggest inequality in the world and the most critical economic relation on the planet is that between the masses of people in Asia, Africa, and Latin America on the one hand, and the imperialist countries which parasitically feed off of those people. So it is no surprise that when the United States wages economic warfare on Venezuela, warfare which has resulted in 40,000 deaths from American sanctions on their economy, BS tacitly supports it. He demurs from the idea of an invasion to cover his left flank, but he still says the U.S. should use its authority, and that's a quote, to remove the government. Authority which rests on what? On a American military power derived from and protecting American plunder. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt. It's very interesting, actually. I read an argument that Bernie Sanders had with a reporter for the New York Times this past weekend about his Bernie Sanders' opposition to U.S. policy in the 70s and 80s. And Sanders raised the example of Chile. That's where Salvador Allende got elected president and began implementing a program very similar to that of Bernie Sanders. More social welfare, some restraints on the capitalists, but not touching A, their property, or B, their army and police. Guess what happened? The CIA sponsored a coup in Chile, ironically enough, on September 11th, 1973, in which the army murdered Salvador Allende, along with at least 3,000 other people, and sent tens of thousands of people into exile. If somehow Bernie Sanders did get elected, and if he somehow could implement parts of his program, what do you think would happen? How do you think the capitalist imperialists here, who took out Allende, would view even the relatively minor reforms that Bernie Sanders called socialism? And how long before they made him an offer he couldn't refuse? Or do you think they would be more tolerant and forgiving here in their home base than they were in Chile? That is why a revolution, a real revolution, to bring in real socialism, actually requires the defeating and dismantling of the instruments of force and repression that serve the old system. So best case, if Bernie Sanders actually stuck to his principles and somehow did get elected, would be this Allende the sequel. But on the real, BS is getting you involved in the process and setting you up to join the Democratic veal pen and the whole electoral circus, just like he did last time. Or let's look at the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal promises that Americans are going to keep the same standard of living and somehow save the environment at the same time. But do the math. The 5% of the world's people who live here in America consume 25% of the world's resources. You are not going to deal with the most pressing crisis humanity has ever faced without radically restructuring and reorienting everything, including how America relates to the whole world, as well as the basic rules of how production is even conceived and carried out. And certainly the standard of living based on this country's parasitically sucking the blood of the world's people would be one thing that has to be overturned. Capitalism requires that capitalists and nation states compete with each other and be victorious on pain of going under. Expand or die is the first commandment of this system. And I don't know if they taught you that in your class or not, but that's the cold hard facts. And so long as that holds sway, any deal, green or otherwise, must work within those parameters. Or else, we're back to Chile, 1973, again, without any preparation of the people for what is going to come. Humanity right now has stage 4 cancer. And the Green New Dealers are telling us they have a painless way to deal with it, when what we urgently need is high-dose chemo and radical surgery. If somebody's selling you something, a cure that's not a cure, that's not just bullshit, it does harm. That doctor, that medicine will kill you. Then there's intersectionality. Or that's what Tala's article is about. Or what's devolved into, let's all adjudicate and argue over who's got the most privilege and make sure that nobody appropriates anybody else's oppression. Intersectionality claims to take into account all the different forms of oppression and how they intersect. But first off, this too ignores the biggest privilege in the world, that of the imperialist domination over the rest of the world's people. And leaving that aside, which of course you cannot and should not, is society mainly just a matrix of intersecting oppressions and identities? Such a viewpoint rules out of order any way to do what Tala said, to scientifically understand the deep and driving dynamics at the core of any social system and the roots of all the various forms of oppression people face. And you can scientifically understand it. Let's remember the point I just made on the capitalist commandment of expand or die and investigate one of the two greatest crimes of American history. What gave rise to the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade and then the centuries of slavery in the Western Hemisphere? Did the ideology of racism, did the ideas of racism in the minds of white people give rise to slavery? Or did the insatiable needs of capital create that slave trade? And on that arose a whole superstructure of ideas that justified the unspeakable barbaric cruelty of it. Then what gave rise to the drive to eliminate slavery after three centuries? And within the US to the Civil War. Why did that happen? Why did the Reconstruction after the Civil War take the course that it did, only to be followed by Jim Crow segregation and sharecropping in the South? Why did the Great Migration from the South to the cities of North and South happen when it happened? And why in the 1970s did the so-called War on Drugs wreak havoc on the black community, as well as other oppressed communities? It is not as if this is one from one answered by what's going on with the economic relations. What people do and think does make a tremendous difference, but that takes place on a stage that is set by this underlying dynamic. These forms of oppression in those five stops, they all have a life of their own, and they have all been stitched into the functioning of this capitalist imperialist society. If we can understand them scientifically, where they come from and how they work, we can figure out how to unstitch them, how to uproot them through making revolution. And that same science tells you, that same study of the evidence for the underlying dynamics that explains it, tells you that you must have a revolution to clear the decks in order to even get to work in any kind of way on these. Again, that's what she was speaking to in her opening remarks. I just on this intersectionality, I recently went to an evening of what was called intergenerational dialogue between Kimberly Crenshaw, who's somebody who actually has done very important work and taking some important stands in certain spheres, and is one of the founders of intersectionality, and some younger person who is very influenced by her. And some of what Kimberly Crenshaw has done is a project called Say Her Name, which foregrounds the fact that in addition to the men who have been killed by the police, there are a great many black women and Latino women and Native women who have also been killed by the police. And she talked movingly, but never once during that whole night did I hear her talk to this younger generation of how we have to get beyond all this and how we can get beyond all this, how we don't want to have another intergenerational dialogue 40 years from now going over the same ground, addressing the same exact problems of police murder. So intersectionality is not just neutral. It leaves us mentally trapped in tinkering in the present, and all too often pointing fingers within that same matrix of oppressions. And in that way, therefore, it too actively does harm. It holds things back. In everything, in all these different ways out that are posed to young people coming forward, we keep coming back to the choices laid out by Bob Avakian and spoken to by the last two speakers. Either we live with this and condemn future generations to the same or worse, if they have a future at all, or we make revolution. Now, there's many more bullshit solutions. I suppose it would be good to address. There's no end to them, but I only have time for one, the biggest one, and the ones that all the other ones default into eventually, which usually goes, yeah, I know we need something radical, but right now we just got to beat Trump. So that means we got to vote for the Democrats. And it is true that the fascism of this Trump-Pence regime represents a very direct and very dire threat to humanity, okay? I mean, we get that. For 2.5 years, we have been struggling tirelessly with all kinds of people to join with us in trying to drive out this regime through nonviolent mass struggle in the streets. But voting for Democrats does not get you there. It does not represent an alternative. And right now, look, the situation is very raw with this. Trump said just a few weeks ago, this is an exact quote. Trump said, I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until things get to a certain point. And then it would be very bad, very bad. In other words, if things get to a certain point, Trump's going to unleash extra legal violence against his rivals and whoever else he deems as an enemy. Okay, but surely Nancy Pelosi said something in response. Did she say, here's a true or false, did she say, well, if Trump does that, then we're going to help refuse fascism to mobilize people to righteously defend themselves in the rule of law and to nonviolently drive this fascist regime out of office? Did she go on and say, and hey, if through the course of that struggle it leads to people questioning the whole system and how that system got us into this mess in the first place, and if masses of people eventually go forward to make revolution and overthrow this system, well then, so be it. Actually, no. She said, well, here's what she did say though. She said, well, if we don't beat him by a landslide, he's not gonna leave office. Think about that. The fascist president says, if things don't go my way in the election, I will unleash tremendous violence, even civil war. And the main Democratic leader basically surrenders in advance. Why did she do that? Because the Democrats are a party of this system. And for them, the most important thing is the continued function of this system and the dominance of America worldwide. And while the Republicans are indeed fascists, the Democratic Party is a machine of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And if that seems an exaggeration to you, then I invite, and even if it doesn't, I invite you to look at the centerfold of our special BEB issue of the Revolution newspaper. And BEB stands for... okay, bourgeois electoral bullshit. The job of the Democrats is not to represent you. The job of the Democrats is to control you, okay? And it's and what they have done these past 2 years to defang and mislead what began as a huge revulsion against this fascism, and unfortunately how successful they've been at it, has been truly unconscionable. And it underscores the need to fundamentally break with them. Again, two choices. Either we live with this and swallow the horrors, tilling our gardens while the tidal wave rolls closer, or we make revolution. And if you want to contest us in the Q&A on this, that's part of why we're here. But look, if you're one of the people who thinks there's no alternative, like her friend, or no way to beat them, and that people can't change, you're wrong. There is a way out. All this suffering is unnecessary. We don't have to live with this. And you don't have to make peace with the zombies or become one yourself. You don't have to be someone who ends up reading the news, swiping to the next thing, and muttering to yourself, must not be a big deal. We can make a revolution, and you can and need to be a part of that. The first socialist revolutions in Russia in 1917 and China in 1949 held power for a few decades and were then defeated and turned back into a mutant form of capitalism. When these revolutions were made in what at the time were two of the most wretched and war-torn countries on earth, what did the capitalist imperialists around the world do? Guess what? Yeah, you got it. Guess what? They didn't say, wow, that's such a good idea. I really like your idea. Why don't you see if you can make it work? Obviously, they did the opposite. With Nazi Germany sending the main might of its army against the Soviet Union in the most brutal invasion of all time, one that took the lives of over 20 million people, and with the U.S. threatening to invade and nuke China 9 months after the revolution came to power there. But even up against all that and more, these revolutions accomplished incredible things in the relatively brief time they held power. For those of you who have had the opposite drummed into your head by this educational system and all too many intellectuals of this system, let me suggest a thought experiment. Try to imagine looking at the Civil War and Reconstruction through the eyes of slave masters, Confederate generals, and their apologists. Because, as a matter of fact, up until the 1960s, the overwhelming consensus that you would get on the campuses like this, and for sure in the popular culture, was that the Civil War was at best a tragic misunderstanding, and that Reconstruction was a disaster. I mean, sometimes, like the movie Gone with the Wind, which when I was a kid was the biggest movie ever, they made the fucking slave masters the heroes and the people you sympathized with. Anyway, it was only when another generation, a revolutionary generation, came along and questioned that verdict that the real truth, not some counter-narrative or an alternate narrative, but the truth, was dug up and fought for. The truth that slavery was always at the heart of the American economy and American society. The truth that the Civil War was fought over this. The truth that the main problem with Reconstruction was that it did not go far enough in empowering the former slaves and stripping the planter class of its power. And the truth that the betrayal of Reconstruction was one of the great crimes of this ruling class and has been a big part of why we're in the situation we're in today. So to return to the subject at hand, we have the actual history that you can find out of this first stage of the communist revolution. It's on revcom.us. And it's an interview with Raymond Lada. I forget the exact title of it. If anybody, you don't know what you think you know. It starts there and it goes on for a while, but check that out. At the same time, I also want to say this. These first revolutions also made serious, even grievous mistakes. Some were more or less unavoidable, and some were due to real shortcomings and blind spots in the understanding and method of the people who led those revolutions. They had the idea of getting to a world of freely associating human beings without exploitation, oppression, and antagonistic social conflicts. But their conception of how to reach that goal, their method of understanding society, ironically, could not allow them to get there. At times, it became, frankly, a sort of religious ideal, all too often backed up by measures that worked against the scientific method and emancipatory goals of the movement. What is so incredibly important now that Tala was pointing to is someone has come forward to do the work to both deeply analyze this whole first stage of revolution, as well as other areas of human inquiry and endeavor. And on that basis has written the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America. And that someone is Bob Avakian. I want to talk about this Constitution for a minute. It is not a pipe dream. It is a realistic and visionary blueprint and guideline for a whole new society, a society with a clear goal, one where the scientific outlook is being spread and taken up, and at the same time where there's a great deal of ferment and initiative coming from all kinds of places in forging the course to get there. The new power, the revolutionary power, will lead people from day one in changing everything old and rotten, in uprooting those five stops and all their expressions in a way consistent with the relations and the values of the world we're trying to get to. And it'll support revolution all over the world. This Constitution gives leadership to a whole process where people are going to be able to thrash through what is true and go forward together through what will be very challenging circumstances to create a whole new world. And it also shows how the rights of individuals will be protected throughout that whole process. I want to read here a quote from Bob Avakian that I think captures the significance of this new Constitution. This is from the book, The New Communism, where he goes a great deal into what is new about this communism. He says, one of the things that should really be understood about the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic, in most fundamental terms, is that this Constitution is dealing with a very profound and very difficult contradiction. The contradiction that on the one hand, humanity really does need revolution and communism, but on the other hand, not all of humanity wants that all of the time, including in socialist society. So this Constitution is set up to provide the basic methods and means to deal with that contradiction. At times, a lot of people may want to be going in a different direction, but you've got the institutional means through this Constitution to keep the socialist system going towards the ultimate goal of communism, unless overwhelmingly the people are against you. But at the same time, this Constitution is constructed in such a way that you, speaking to those who are leading this new society, have to repeatedly win masses of people to fight to stay on that socialist road. You need to get to communism. Again, communism is a society where people have reached the stage where there's no government, no state. There's government, but no state. And they're freely associating and coming together to produce the necessities of life and carry out every, art, science, everything else. You need to go to communism, but you're not going to get to communism by putting guns in the backs of people and force marching them. You have to continually win them to that, fighting through all the contradictions that get posed, including the ones that the enemies put in your way or accentuate in order to turn the people against you. And that's quite huge and quite historic. But it's not only that there's this blueprint and guideline for a new society, a real viable alternative. There's a strategy that can actually win revolution against this monstrous power we face every day. And this too was brought forward by B.A. And you can get the basics of this in his speech that you can watch on RevCom, his speech, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, a speech he gave last summer, or which you can come to South Central, Crenshaw and Slauson this Saturday, and watch with us and talk about it with a whole bunch of people who you may not see here at UCLA so often. Part of our revolution is that people cross the tracks and break down divisions, even now. Just to be clear, the strategy he puts forward, the strategy he's developed, is not easy. It's not a walk in the park. There will be sacrifice. But this strategy is grounded in a scientific understanding of how societies can radically change seemingly overnight, of what opens up when they do, of how a force that starts out small and weak can defeat a force that starts out big and strong, and how you come out of that with something radically better and not just the bitter residue of dashed hopes and a missed opportunity. Finally, there's leadership. B.A., who has not only never given up in all these years, but has forged something new for humanity, who's never stopped fighting to lead, no matter how hard it was and no matter what they came at him with, who has always maintained his deep bond with the basic people of this society, his poetic spirit, and his sense of humor. There's B.A. and there are the revolutionary forces around him whom he leads and who are on this tour, part of whom are on this tour. So there is an analysis, there is a strategy, there is not only a vision, but a concrete blueprint for a new society, and there is leadership. But what we don't have are the people we need to put this on the political and ideological map in this country. We are on a mission right now with this tour to organize a few thousand people into a revolutionary force over the next year or so. Even with a few thousand people, you can have a major impact on what people throughout society think they have to put up with, what people think is possible, and what they want to do on that basis. We could change everything with just a few thousand people. And we need you here to be part of that in whatever way and on whatever level you can to begin with. If you agree with those 5-6 points of attention that Noche read, you need to be part of this. You need to be in this club. There's a contribution you can make as you learn more. We know a lot, but we do not have all the answers. Let me give some examples. We know we need a very big student movement and a very radical student movement. We know we need to win the section of the allegiance of at least a section of the intellectuals. We know that we need a radical culture and not this revolting culture we have, something much more radical than aspiring to be the next Bill Gates. We have some ideas on that, but there's a lot we don't know. And we all need to be working on these and the many other challenges we face. A lot of work has been done, but there's a lot of work that we together need to start doing. The hour is very late, as Tala said. There is a way that you can be part of changing everything as part of this tour. And let me say this, because of the work that BA has done, we don't have to grope for the way out as the clock ticks. It's there. When you go home tonight, You can go online, or you can buy this book here. I don't know if we can sell things, but you can go online and read this book by Ardea Skybreak, Science and Revolution, which is a guide to what BA has done and what he's all about. At one point, she's talking about somebody, the interviewer asked her, well, what does it mean to get into BA? And she says, the first thing is follow your conscience and follow your convictions and follow the trail to see what he does say, given that this guy's been doing decades of work analyzing why these problems keep happening, what they are rooted in, what's the fundamental reason these terrible things keep happening in society, and what could be done about it. She gets into what that means, and she comes back around and says, and by the way, when you take this out to others, expect to be mocked, ridiculed, criticized, to be told you don't know what you're talking about, okay? But don't give up when that happens. Do the best you can in answering things on the basis of what you've been learning. But when you run into things you don't understand well enough, go back to BA, go back to his materials, dig in a little deeper, talk to other people who know more about this, ask them for help so that you can keep spreading this among the people. Look, we say people are sleepwalking. A lot of people, they get angry when you wake them up, even if you're waking them up to tell them their house is on fire, okay? You will get pushback, but there's a way to understand it and a way to deal with it. The main thing is this: do not stand aside. Be part of this. Learn more about it. Figure out where you can fit into this and begin getting going. I'm going to end my part of this by playing BA himself, talking about what we're trying to do in this period, now with this tour, and the important role for everybody to play in this revolution. And this is from a question and answer session in New York last summer. So if you could play the excerpt now.
The reason that I wanted to do what we're doing here today is because we need a lot of new people to come into this revolution, become part of this revolution, help to solve the problems of the revolution. I know you might be saying, well, what, you know, how am I going to solve the problems of the revolution? I just heard about this 6 weeks ago. Well, everybody starts somewhere, you know, and everybody has things to contribute. And we really need people to become part of this revolution. And, you know, like I said, people should start with what they, you know, can readily do and feel confident doing, that can contribute and learn more and contribute more and keep advancing. And come in at the point which you're convinced about all of this, including the atheism. Come into the party and help to strengthen the party to be the revolutionary vanguard it needs to be. And meanwhile, go out there and work among broader numbers of people, even while you're learning and struggling and determining whether you do agree with all of it. Help bring forward more people to be part of this process so that we can actually very quickly, and I don't mean in a week or a month, but we don't have indefinite time. Look what's going on in the world. So that we can move to where there are thousands of people organized into this revolution. And believe me, if there are thousands of people organized into this revolution, all acting in a unified way, not, I don't mean like, I think the same thing as you, I don't have any ideas of my own. No. But I mean having a scientific approach, and struggling together to recognize and solve the problems of the revolution. If you have thousands of people who are doing that, you're going to influence and impact the whole society in a very big way. So this is what we need. You know, it's, look, I've said this before, it has to be understood in the right way, but the millions and billions of suffering people in the world are counting on us even though they don't know it. And a lot of them will tell us that we're wrong and you don't know what you're talking about. I was going to swear, but I've done enough swearing for today. But you don't know what you're talking about. You know, that's not going to get anywhere. Nobody's down with that. Even all those people who tell us that are, even though they don't know it, they're counting on us in a real sense, because this, what is represented by what we're talking about and grappling with here, is the only way forward out of this madness for these masses, millions and literally billions of people, whether they know it yet or not. So this is a responsibility that we're all called on to take up and contribute in whatever ways we can while we're learning more and struggling more and struggling with each other and struggling to understand things more deeply and saying what we think is wrong if we think something is wrong and fighting it out. I don't mean, you know, this way, but I mean, you know, struggling it out to figure out what's right and how to go forward. This is what we all are called on to do. And to go out and get, you know, what we're called on to do most of all is to go out and bring forward a lot more people to become part of this with us.